Stay hungry, stay foolish.
Now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Nir Eyal, author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Welcome to the show, Nir.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, so I read your fantastic book. I'm a follower of your blog, and I just thought your work is so important for people working in digital media, innovation. Anybody who's building products today need to understand what you do. So I'm just going to open up the mic to you, man, and just let us know about the process of building habit-forming products.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's something that I thought was very important too. And in fact, my story is that I've helped start two companies that were acquired since then. And after my last company was acquired, I had some free time on my hands, and I was trying to figure out what I would do next. And I just came up with this thesis that habits were really going to matter. This was back in 2012, and I could tell that the trajectory of where things were going were that digital technologies are becoming smaller and smaller. And as the real estate shrinks, meaning the amount of room we have to give people visual cues is decreasing with every shrinking screen size. So when we went from desktops, right, big screens on desks, to laptops, to mobile, to then wearable, and now in terms of audible interfaces, what we've seen is that the interface has completely disappeared, right? With Amazon Alexa and with Siri, what's happening is that the interface is disappearing. So what that means is if you can't create a user habit, if you can't be top of mind, if you can't be the first to mind solution, you don't exist. And so that means that companies really have to start thinking about how do they form habits? How do they create associations in people's minds so that they become the product that people think of first before the competition?
Yeah, so the human factor has become so important, because when people build products, they think of things and building things, but they forget about the end user and that this needs to be built for somebody, a person, and the value systems of that person at the end of the line.
Right. And also the psychology of the kind of value that even the user can't tell you they need. I mean, that's the thing. I think, a lot of us have smartened up about how to build products, and we no longer just build what the highest paid person, the hippo, says we should build. We don't build what the investors say we should build. That's not how we do things anymore. We do customer development. We talk to customers. We listen to what they need. The problem is, of course, that customers have all these inarticulatable needs, meaning things that they need their products to do, but they can't tell you they need it. Why? Because these needs are these deep psychological needs like loneliness, satisfying boredom, fatigue, uncertainty. Nobody can tell you, I'd really love a product to alleviate my boredom because I feel lonely. Well, that's exactly what Facebook does. Yeah. But of course, a customer couldn't tell you they needed that product.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because when I read your book, I thought also of Clayton Christensen and his concept of what do you hire a product to do? And
right, I was thinking the job to be done.
Yeah, the job to be done. And I thought, that putting your work as a layer on top of that work.
Yeah, I still kind of chew on it. I have the utmost respect for Clayton. I think he's influenced the field so much. I love his work. But I'm still chewing on that concept. It's clear, the what's so powerful about that model is, he gives this classic example of people don't want a hammer, they want the hole in the wall that it creates so that they can hang their picture.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So that's why they want the hammer. But then, you even go a step further. Well, why? If you keep asking why, you actually realize that if you keep going enough levels of depth, really the only reason we buy anything, is to modulate our mood. It's to provide a psychological relief. What we really want from that hammer is to ease the wanting of the job. Not the job itself, but the wanting of the job, the annoyance of that job not being done. And I think the reason I bring that up is because when you think in that frame of mind, you actually open yourself up to thinking about, well, how else could we satisfy that? Does it have to be a picture on the wall that I hang up with this hammer? Is there other things that might satisfy that person in ways I haven't yet considered? So, I think it's even imperative to go deeper than just the job to be done, but also what's the psychological itch that I'm going to scratch?
Yeah, so asking the right questions. So beyond the hiring, and then and that kind of leads nicely into your framework. So your trigger action reward activation framework that you talk about in Hooked. Can we talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So the ultimate goal of a habit forming product is to build an association, to create a memory with an internal trigger. Internal triggers are things that prompt the user to action, that tell us what to do next. But the information for what to do next is stored in the user's head. And the most frequent internal triggers are these negative emotions like fear, boredom, uncertainty, fatigue, loneliness. All of these things, we look for relief from these negative emotional states, these what we call negative valence states in psychology. So we constantly look to figure out how to take us out of that discomfort. And we use products and services to satisfy that discomfort. So when I'm lonely, I check Facebook or maybe Tinder. When I'm uncertain, I go on Google. When I am bored, maybe I'll check the news. I'll check stock prices, sports scores. All of these things cater to these painful internal triggers. Now, what we want to do as product designers is to figure out what's our itch and does it occur frequently enough in the user's life for us to attach to. And so the time span is about a week or less. That the more frequently someone uses the product, the more likely they are to form a habit. But really, the cutoff is about a week's time or less. That's how frequently you need people to engage if you want to change their habits. So after we figure out the internal trigger, then we figure out the action. The action is the simplest behavior done in anticipation of a reward. And that could be something as simple as scrolling on Pinterest or pushing the play button on YouTube or a quick search on Google. All of these things are very simple, solitary behaviors in anticipation of an immediate reward. Then comes the reward itself, and typically it's not just a reward, it's a variable reward, meaning there's some kind of uncertainty, some kind of mystery around what I might find or how this product helps me gain agency and control over an inherently variable situation. We can talk more about variable rewards, the fascinating part of the Hook model. And then finally, the investment phase. This is probably the most overlooked of the four steps of the Hook. The investment phase is where the user puts something into the product to bring themselves back in the future. And they do that by storing value. And this is why I'm so excited about the prospect of technology changing all our lives today, is because, you know, unlike things in the physical world, things made out of atoms like your chair, your desk, your clothing, all of these things depreciate, right? They lose value with wear and tear. But habit-forming products, the miracle of these habit-forming products is that they should get better with use. And that's a really big deal. That's never been possible before. So the more I use Facebook, the more I use Pinterest, Instagram, WhatsApp, Slack, any of these products, either in consumer web or in the enterprise, the good ones get better the more you use them. And that's really amazing. And so that's that fourth principle of the Hook model. The investment phase is what loads the next trigger. It brings the user back and it stores value over time. And that through successive cycles through these four steps, this is how customer preferences are shaped and how tastes are formed.
And then you get to the internalization phase. So when this happens, then it's internalized and it's a habit.
Exactly. So that eventually, what's amazing about these habit-forming products is that you almost never see them spending a lot of money on expensive ads, right? You don't see Facebook and Twitter and Slack and Instagram and Snapchat. You don't see these guys advertising in the Super Bowl because you know they're worth billions of dollars, these companies, and yet you don't really see them spending much money on advertising because they're not changing our minds through ads like the brands of yesteryear would have, like Exxon and Geico and Marlboro cigarettes. The only tool they had was the exposure, right? Using the mere exposure effect to change our preferences. But these companies do it in a much different way. The experience itself is what changes our minds, what forms these habits.
Yeah, and can we talk about the mere exposure effect, just to explain to the audience what that is near?
Sure. So the mere exposure effect is why advertising works. That the more times you see a brand, the more you will like it. For no other reason for the fact that you have seen it before, that you've been exposed to it. This, in a nutshell, explains Donald Trump. For all the prognosticating around why Donald Trump is succeeding, let me tell you, this is why. It's because the public has seen his name, and it's a great brand. I mean, what a great brand. To Trump is just such a great brand name. The public has been exposed to this brand name for decades on buildings. There's a reason that Donald Trump understands to put his name as big as he possibly can on every building to watch him on The Apprentice. He, in many people's minds, is a brand that they like simply because they have seen it millions of or maybe hundreds of thousands of times in their life, the same way that we like Coca-Cola over Pepsi, or like one brand of gasoline over the other, or one sports team over the next. Is significantly influenced just because we have seen that effect, that brand again and again and again.
It's really interesting because you talk about this actually even for networking. If I'm actually a sales guy or I'm into networking, that I need to go to these events and be seen at those events, because that mere exposure effect happens with people as well. So you're seen at the event, people are more likely, as long as you're not... You're not a total jackass.
Yeah.
And you're a nice person, and you're at these events. You're just your presence, and going, oh, that's that guy, and he represents this. That you become a brand in yourself. Yeah.
I mean, in a way, yes. The problem, of course, is that it's not scalable, right? That you can only go to so many events and see so many people. I think what we see with the internet is that when you use something like content marketing, right? The way I built my business. Not intentionally, but what's happened is because I kept writing my blog consistently and sharing my thoughts, some of them are bad and I've changed my mind on something, but sometimes I write something that's good and lasts. The fact that the internet can spread good content for me is amazing, right? I get all that mere exposure, for free, essentially. I don't have to pay for advertising. Now, what would be even better than that is to build a product that doesn't even rely on mere exposure. If you think about how all the companies I described earlier, what they do, it's not the exposure to the brand itself that makes us habituated to these products. It's the fact that using it creates a habit, and that's eminently scalable.
Yeah, because I was thinking about the trigger, and you know, unbeknownst to many people, those triggers are built into the product. So when you see a little one symbol or two symbol or a little red dot to signify that there's been some action on your social feed or your Twitter. You talk about Twitter and how they're actually built to drag you in and to actually give you a trigger every single time, and push notifications being a fantastic trigger.
Sure. Yeah. So those are examples of external triggers. They tell the user what to do next with some bit of information. So that would be something like a push notification, an email, an SMS, even word of mouth. All of these things are examples of external triggers.
And can we talk, Nir, your background, because it's really interesting. You've set up and you've sold on companies. Can we talk about you for a moment? And because I think it's interesting in that, you know, a lot of startups don't have this psychological understanding of the mere exposure effect, the different triggers, habit forming products, and you're kind of melting pot of bringing that into a startup world or a technical world or a digital media world is really interesting.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So my background is that, you know, I didn't start out as an author. I started out as an entrepreneur and helped start and sold two companies. And, where my experience come from is that in my last company, I was at the intersection of gaming and advertising. So I was constantly looking at these different companies coming and going inside making games and making ads. And, you know, these are two industries that rely upon mind control. I'll be honest with you, right? Advertisers don't spend all that money for their health, and gaming companies know exactly what makes you click and what makes you tick better than you understand yourself. And so that's where I really picked up all this know-how. What was frustrating to me is that I didn't see any how-to guide. I didn't see any, manual out there for how do we actually use this outside those industries. And so that's really the guidebook that I didn't find and that I wanted to write, so that all of us, people building healthy habits, right? How many of your listeners are working on products and services that really, truly could help people's lives if they only use the product?
Yeah, and it's great.
That's the problem.
It's crazy because you even see it with medication. People with life-threatening disease or illnesses are avoid their medication, and you're kind of going, or somebody who's got, you know, diabetes, or somebody who's obese and is avoiding the gym. Because I thought about this beyond the product, and I thought about it actually from a gym perspective. So even as simple as going to the gym. If you build a habit using your framework, So, you know, and building and stuff like doing at the same time every day, having a reward like lunch even afterwards, that actually sticks.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's not simple to do. The real, you know, what you want to be careful of is you don't want to make the behavior something that people do only for an extrinsic motivator. Extrinsic motivators are things that have nothing to do with the key behavior itself. So the classic example is that when you tell children that they'll get a reward, they'll get candy if they draw a picture. They tend to draw really crappy pictures because the only reason they're doing it is because they want to get the reward. But the children who do it for the sake of enjoying the drawing actually draw much better pictures. So that's the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic rewards. And so what we want to be very careful of is not to motivate a behavior simply because of an extrinsic motivator. What we want to do is to find something that's inherently pleasurable, right? That's the best. Like socializing, for example, is something that humans love. We have always loved for 200,000 years since our species first evolved. We are social species. So interacting with one another on these social networks is something that we naturally crave and we find rewarding. So that's always the best place to look, is to look for things that people do already offline and then bring them online to make them easier, faster, better.
Yeah, because that is a point I love, Nir, because if you think about corporate culture or any kind of company, and you think about the values or the value systems of those companies or the carrot for somebody to perform, and that's why you see startups so driven, because they're usually intrinsic motivators.
Right.
Instead of like a bonus, or, you know, I'm working purely to get my paycheck.
Great point. I mean, if you're starting a business for to be the next Mark Zuckerberg, or because you want a lot of money, then you're just bad at math, because the odds are horrible that will actually happen for you.
Like, have you any advice for that? So if I'm in a fledgling company and I'm about to scale up, I'm in that fortunate position where I've got there, how to build a company for today's world or today's mindsets that use intrinsic motivators?
Yeah, I think it starts with, you know, a unique perspective that you have. I think the best hack that I don't think people think about enough is that you really need to build something for yourself. That, you know, as you mentioned before, you have to think about your own intrinsic motivation. So if the only reason you want to do a startup is because you want to get rich, that's just a dumb reason to start a company. Your chances are minuscule. However, if you start a product or service because you want the product, right? You are the user. You want the thing that you're going to build. That's a great reason to build a company. That's something that you can do in your nights and weekends. You don't have to quit your job. You can work on that product. You can build it. It's easier than ever to learn how to code, to learn how to design. I mean, all that knowledge is out there. The only thing missing is your will to actually make it happen. So that's my advice, is to, you know, use the competitive advantage that you have of knowing what the customer wants by being the customer, right? You be the user. And if you look at the pattern of all the companies that we admire over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Slack, Snap, all of these companies were founded by people who follow that formula. They were building products for themselves first.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we did an interview with Dennis Mortensen, the founder of X.ai. And he told me what he does is he keeps a hate list, things that just annoy him so badly that he wants to fix them. And then he comes back to that list. And one of the things was sorting out his inbox, sorting out his diary. And he created Amy and X.ai out of that need. And it's so true, that because you become your best customer, and then you're obviously able to represent the product better than anyone else as well.
Exactly. Because, you know, coming across user insights is so difficult. To try and build a product for someone else, not impossible. People can do it, of course. But if you have the opportunity to build for yourself, I would always take that opportunity first.
Yeah. And so one of the things I thought was really interesting that you talk about is freemium model. So you talk about gaming, and obviously your background in that, you know, these 30-day trials, that they all happen to be around 30 days. Yes, it's a month, but also it's the time around it needs to create a habit. Can we talk about that? Because somebody, we have a lot of companies listening to the show who are SaaS products.
And
the 7-day or the 14-day or 28-day trial, have you any tips around that to build it into a habit?
Right. So the idea is that you want to form that habit. You want to make sure you pass people through the four steps of the hook model, the trigger, the action, the reward, and investment, so that by the time it becomes a habit, now they have to pay, right? This is Slack's story, right? When the more people invested, but when they got through the four steps and ended up with the investment phase and invited other people, connected APIs, then it became something that they needed, right? It suddenly became a painkiller versus a vitamin. And that's the trick. That's why we would want to do this. We want to show people how valuable the product is for a given period of time. And once they form that habit, now it's so valuable to them that they'll be glad to pay.
That's a great line, a painkiller versus the vitamin. I love that. I don't think people really, when I told people about the investment, I don't think they really got that. And I was saying, like, it's like almost like YouTube being user generated content, that the more you upload, it's almost like a network effect. The better it is for everybody on that platform, or it's like Amazon, the more sellers and buyers you have, the better it is for everyone. That's a type of investment as well.
Exactly. Absolutely. Investment in the network effect.
Yeah. And because there's a couple of pieces of the pie now coming together. We talked about, you know, the Clayton Christensen asked the right questions. We talked about the psychology of what problem you're solving. And we talked about your hook model. And then if you actually add in the network effect there, I was just thinking of a framework. And if you look at those four elements as a whole, and then you just concentrate on, okay, this is my framework, and now I'm going to work on actually creating a kick-ass product, that's a good framework. It's a good starting point.
Sure, sure. I mean, the point of the hook model is to save you a lot of time, money, and heartache building the wrong thing. So instead of, you know, hiring a designer and coding and doing all that work up front, which is what people typically do, they get all excited and start spending a lot of money on stuff. You know, all you have to do is take out a pen and paper, and with this hook model, you can evaluate, look, if my business model requires people to come back on their own, if that's a requirement for my business to stay alive, then do I have the four basic elements of the hook, the trigger, the action, the reward, and the investment? And that's worth its weight in gold, right? If you can look at that and say, oh my gosh, this is never going to become a habit because we're missing one of these four requirements, terrific, great, kill your product, move on to the next thing, and don't waste your life. And if you say, wow, we do pass, there's a high chance here. Okay, great. Now we're going to invest in actually doing some prototyping.
Yeah, and even the investment, like you mentioned, Slack, but it can be as much as uploading data, like so your CSV of your contact base, and then inviting people so they start using it. And it's that kind of thought process as well, beyond your own personal investment. It's actually, as you said, plugging in APIs that you end up kind of getting so embedded in the product that you can't leave it.
Right, exactly, right. The more you invest, the more it becomes a painkiller.
Yeah, so, Nir, I'm just wary of your time. We committed to 20 minutes. The book is fantastic. It's available on Amazon. That's where I got it. And your blog as well, nirandfar.com.
Exactly, nirandfar.com. Nir is spelled like my first name, N-I-R, nirandfar.com. And actually, if you subscribe to my blog, then I give you a workbook that's a supplement to Hook that kind of walks you through how to build habit-forming products in that free workbook.
Okay, well, Nir, really appreciate your time, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Nir Eyal, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.